Well, how much time did you take to get ready this morning? Just to come here, what did it take you just to be presentable? Whatever that looks like for you. And all of us are a little bit different. I get it. Because as some of you, if you're single, if you're on your own, maybe you took your time a little bit. You got up, or maybe you slept in. I don't know. You got up early. You had some time. You had a shower, did the makeup and the hair, or had a shave. You go pick out your outfit. I don't know. Maybe some of you got up really early this morning. You had lots of luxurious time to do that. Maybe some of us, we got out of bed at the last possible minute for most of my life. That's been my MO. Just push it till I absolutely have to get up, and then you just kind of sprint from there into the shower, grab whatever you have to put on, quick look in the mirror, and get out of there. If you have kids here today, especially small kids, you're probably thinking, whatever, man, I wasn't worried about my own appearance. I was worried about getting the kids ready. You got out of bed, you wrestled with them for 45 minutes, finally got them into clothes, checked the mirror quickly, just push them into the car, and you're just happy that you're here. If you're Kaylee, I don't know if you guys noticed, Kaylee was just hosting here. She obviously thought really long and hard about her outfit. I don't know if you noticed her shirt. It says, what does it say? I'm with the hot drummer. So she had to at least take that few quick moments to make sure that her husband was on drums today, which I can confirm that he was. But that's just one of those moments where if you're in too much of a rush or if you're not paying attention, you just grab a shirt, throw it on, and who knows where that could go and how that could look. Could be an interesting Sunday. But I bet you put a little bit of time into your appearance this morning. Maybe not as much as you would like, or maybe you did have time, but a lot of us, we're just trying to get there. But you spent a few minutes, and you checked the mirror before you went out to make sure that you were presentable. Or again, maybe if you have small kids, it was just making sure that they look presentable so that you look like a decent parent and that you got them here. Today, I want to talk about this verse that is at the heart of a story. We're in this series, we're talking about King David. And this is at the heart of the story. And it's become kind of a relatively famous verse. If you're in church long enough, you probably heard it. And it simply says this, that people look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. So I don't know how much time you spent on your appearance this morning, making sure that you look good, look presentable. But here's another question. How much time did you spend preparing your heart this morning? How much time did you spend thinking about the state of your heart this week? How much time have you spent really evaluating who you are and how healthy you are deep within your soul this month or this year or on an ongoing basis? People tend to look on the outward appearances because it's obvious, because it's hard not to. And not that it's unimportant, but because it's right there out for us. Because whether we're looking at somebody else or whether it's ourselves, it's one of the first things that we're going to notice. But the Lord looks on the heart. So how's your heart? And how much time do you spend cultivating the health of your heart? Asking how you're doing, where you're at, what's truly important, how you're growing, and where you can go. Today we're talking again about King David. Last week we started by talking about the people who are calling out for a king. And this is a problem for Samuel, and we see for God as he says, hey, these people are rejecting me. They don't want to follow me. They just want to be like everybody else. And so they want the kind of king that everybody else has. And what happened in the story after that is Saul is anointed the first king of Israel. And his story is a little bit up and down. If you read his story, we'll talk a little bit about it today. But this morning, what I want to do is actually go to the next leadership transition where all of a sudden it's being realized that Saul's not working out as king and God is going to anoint a new king. And this is where he anoints King David. King David becomes maybe the most famous Old Testament figure, character in the Bible, if not the most famous, then one of them. And today I want to talk about how he is anointed, and it sheds a little bit of light on Saul and how he did or how well he didn't do, and on David and what the hopes are for King David. So the story is in 1 Samuel 16, 1 Samuel, book of the Bible. It's not too far in from the beginning. If you're looking, you can kind of go from there. You'll move through Joshua, Judges, and get to 1 Samuel. And this is chapter 16, starting in verse 1, the story. It says, "The Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you mourn for Saul since I have rejected him as king over Israel?'" So here's the transition. God has already moved on. Saul is still king and is still going to be king for a while. But God's moving on. He's going to anoint a new king and new leader for the people. He says, "Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king." He takes his oil with him because he's going to anoint the new king with oil. That's how they inaugurate somebody for sacred office, that, hey, you are being chosen, you're going to be the king. But Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears about it, he will kill me." The Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' Invite Jesse to the sacrifice and I will show you what to do. You are to anoint for me the one I indicate." So God is saying, it's time for a new king. I'm going to send you to anoint the new king. That's how everybody's going to know who they are. Take this oil, go do it. Samuel notices right away, and this tells us a bit about Saul, is he says, "Well, how can I just go over there? This is going to be obvious." So don't picture just, you know, this one guy kind of wandering off in secret to this family. But this would have been kind of a big deal. Samuel would have had an entourage or been a bunch of officials that come with him. Would have been really noticeable. And what we're going to learn about Saul is that he's obviously going to be threatened. He's somewhat insecure. He's jealous. He sees that's going to happen. Obviously, that's a threat on his leadership. That's him being told that you're not going to last very long in this position. So Samuel says, "Hey, if I do this, isn't he just going to come and kill me?" And so they kind of come up with, "Well, take a heifer with you so that it looks like you're sacrificing to the Lord with this family." And that's kind of the story that you can go along with, and you can do that. But really what you're going to do once you're there and once you do that sacrifice is you're going to anoint for me the one I tell you to anoint. So verse 4, Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. They asked, "Do you come in peace?" Remember, this isn't just some old man walking in there. This would have been, you know, a big group of people with officials. They would have wondered, "Hey, are you coming to fight us? Are you coming to take stuff from us? Are you friendly? Are you not friendly?" Samuel replied, "Yes, in peace. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Now, I read that verse, a really common verse, and maybe you've heard it before. Oh, yeah, God looks on the inside. But as I was reading this and studying for this, I was trying to figure out, what does this really tell us about the story? Why is this really here? Because we're in the midst of a transition. So Saul is getting ousted. David is coming in. And you got to ask yourself, what is it about Saul that's pushing him out? This idea that people are looking on the outward appearance. So the assumption here is that Saul must look pretty good on the outside. And I always assumed that what the main problem with Saul is that even though he looked good on the outside, he must not be that good on the inside. That's why this verse is here. And so God is going to try and find somebody who looks good, not on the outside, but who is good on the inside. But it kind of bothered me because if you look at the story of Saul and David, there's actually a number of things that are pretty consistent with each other. And so I was wondering, what do we really know about Saul? Why is he being pushed out? And why is David going to replace him? And David's going to end up being spoken of fairly good in the Bible. So here's what we know about Saul when he was anointed king. This is back in 1 Samuel 9. So if you just push back a little bit and you said, well, God anointed him in the beginning, so he must not have been all bad. What is it about Saul that we know? And here's what it says. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Becherath, son of Aphiah, a Benjamite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not the man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. He's a catch. Saul was wealthy. See, that his dad had a lot of money. He came from money. He was handsome. Nobody else was more handsome than Saul. And he was tall. From his shoulders up, it means he was basically a head taller than everybody else. He was tall, handsome, and wealthy. What's wrong with that, eh? Forget king. He's relationship material, isn't he? What else do you want? The total package. He looks so good. But of course, we come to this verse. People look at the outward appearance, and God looks at the heart. And you say, okay, but I mean, he can't be disqualified. Like, he's got resources, he's wealthy, he's good looking, with probably more than handsome, it probably also means healthy, right? People are attracted to healthy people in this culture. That's very important. He's going to be a leader. He's going to guide us. We want to make sure he's going to be around for a while. We want to make sure that he's physically able. So handsome probably isn't just good looking. That's part of it. But also that he's healthy and tall, which comes up a number of times in the verses that we're going to read. There's other ones that we're going to read later. There's this kind of obsession with height. I don't really get, except if you dig really into it. It's probably because the king also needs to be a warrior. He needs to be somewhat intimidating. He's going to be sent into battle. One of the stories we'll talk about next week is the story of David and Goliath, and it's interesting where Saul is still king there, where he plays in, but Goliath is this big, really, really tall guy, and so you have kind of these good storytelling, right? But we also have a wealthy and handsome and tall guy. He's intimidating too. He's going to be able to go into battle and be, you know, a win for us and win for the people, because as we saw last week, as the king goes, so's the kingdom goes, so the people go. We need a representative that we represent, but someone that gets out there and shows this strength and power. And so here we have a guy with resources. He's wealthy, a guy who's healthy and handsome, and a guy who's tall and intimidating. He's got it all. And then you go, so what went wrong with him? Why is he getting kicked out of his office? Why can't he be that? And some people will say, because we got to now compare him to David, who ends up lasting a long time, ends up being the recipient of these incredible promises of God, ends up doing incredible things. And David is called a man after God's own heart. Oh, people look at appearances, but God looks at the heart, and David becomes a man after God's own heart. That's high praise. But why not Saul? What will separate the two? Some say it's because David did good things, but so did Saul. If you look at the life of Saul, he's not perfect, but he did some really good things. Some say it's because Saul did bad things, but so does David. In fact, David does some really, really bad things. We'll get into that. We'll read later in this series about some of the bad things that David did. And so you could say, well, Saul messed up. Well, so did David. And you could argue David maybe messed up a whole lot worse. Some say it's because David was repentant when he did things wrong. But if you read carefully, so did Saul. Saul messes up, but when he messes up, we actually can read this story in the chapters preceding the one that we're at today, but he begs for forgiveness, begs God not to punish him, begs God kind of in this repentant moment. So what is it that discredited Saul? Well, the story that leads to the moment where Saul is deposed, taken off of his throne, here switched. If we read it, Saul was commanded to go win a battle. He was supposed to fight against this group of people who were basically considered terrorists, like the worst of the worst of Israel's enemies. And Saul was, he's commanded, go win this battle. And when you win the battle, just destroy everything. Don't take their stuff. And this would have been common. So in the ancient world, mostly agricultural societies, and you know, they'd fight for land and all this kind of stuff. And so if you went in and you conquered somebody or you won a battle, then you would typically take all their stuff. You would take their cattle, their sheep, their goats, whatever they had, because that was valuable. If they had any kind of treasure, money, valuable, you know, gold, silver, you would take that for you. But the command for Saul was, listen, you just want to get rid of these guys. They are just so terrible. Don't take their stuff. Just destroy it all. Get rid of it all. Don't do any of that. And Saul actually ends up taking a bunch of the stuff. And he leaves their king around. He's supposed to get rid of him too, but he doesn't. He keeps him. And this is a disobedience of the order that God had given him. And here's what's so significant, because you go, well, he disobeyed, but David disobeys too. But look at why he disobeys. This is, I think, striking. This is 1 Samuel 15, verse 24. It says, then Saul said to Samuel, this is him, and this is him in his repentant moment. I'm sorry. When Samuel calls him on it, hey, why'd you do this? Why'd you keep all this stuff? He says, I have sinned. I violated the Lord's command and your instructions. Why? Because I was afraid of the men, and so I gave in to them. The men is his men, the one that are on his side, the one that says, hey, let's keep a bunch of this stuff. Hey, let's And Saul says, I was afraid of them. So here's what I always thought when I heard that verse that says, people look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. I thought, well, here was his fundamental problem, is that Saul looked good on the outside. He was wealthy and he was handsome and he was tall, but he must have been bad on the inside. But that's not so much the truth, or it's not the full truth. It's actually that Saul was looking on the outward appearance rather than treasuring what was on the inside. He was living out the very principle. It wasn't just that he was bad on the inside. It was that he was looking on the outside. He was worried about what Paul or what the people thought about him. It's not so much that he looked good and wasn't. It's that Saul cared too much about how he looked. He was living in the cycle. I'm afraid of what people will think of me. I'm afraid they might think I'm weak. I'm afraid that they might not approve of me. I'm afraid that they might want a different kind of king. The people want to take this stuff. And I was afraid of them. Saul is insecure. Saul is too concerned about how he looks on the outside, rather than living out who he is on the inside. And here's what we find out in this kind of leadership paradigm, right? He's supposed to be the king. And as the king goes, so the kingdom goes. So the people goes. And so important how the king goes, how the king lives, who the king is. And here's what we find, this principle about leadership. Insecure leaders become inauthentic leaders, and inauthentic leaders become ineffective leaders. He's not living out of his heart. He's insecure. Well, what do people think about me? I got to make sure I look good. I got to make sure I'm approved of. I got to make sure the outward signs are there of a good, strong king. And that leads him to be inauthentic. Well, now instead of living out my integrity, I have to go figure out how to make everybody happy. And when you start doing that, you become an ineffective leader. That's why God is looking for somebody who he can connect with heart to heart. Here's what the heart is in the ancient world. For the ancient Israelites, it's not that far off from what we think of when we think of our heart. What are we talking about? It's the center for emotional, intellectual, and moral activities. This is true for us. Now, we've probably in our society, we've romanticized the heart a little bit more than they would have in the ancient world. So we talk a little bit more about lovey-dovey, Valentine's Day stuff, very emotional, very romantic. That's probably not quite the same in the ancient world. But we do understand it, just I think a lot like they do, that when we talk about somebody's heart, oh, you have a good heart, or oh, they've got a strong heart, that we're talking about the core of somebody, that it's where the center from which our emotions or our intellect or our moral activities come from. So this is not just what we do, what we say, how we act, or how we feel, but it's what drives those things. It's that deep down part of us that nobody else can see, from which everything else flows. It's the core of who we are. Saul's heart was set on what other people thought of him. And when we're centered on what other people think of us, we are more concerned about looking good than being good. And that is a big problem. Because just like we see Saul in the story, we become insecure. Of course we become insecure. Because when we want everybody else to think well of us, when that's what drives us, how are people thinking of me? That is an insecure place to be. We cannot control what people think of us. And even when we do get one person or one group of people to think highly of us, hey, we've done well, we've succeeded in their eyes, we know that there's going to be another group of people who think poorly of us because everybody has a different view on what we should be like. And so there's this insecurity that comes with trying to be what other people want us to be. When we're so concerned with our outward appearance and what people think of us, it leads to an insecurity. There's just no place to stand. How can I make people think well of me? Well, you can't. You're going to be insecure if that's where your heart is at. And if you're insecure, it's going to lead you to be inauthentic. Therefore, you're going to go out and you know how you're going to live, how you're going to talk, what you're going to do, where you're going to make decisions are going to be based on what other people think of me. And really what it's going to be is what you think other people think of you, because you don't always know what other people think of you. You can't read their minds. And so you're going to be inauthentic. Instead of being a person of integrity who says, I make decisions based on what I believe is right and who I really am and what my convictions are, you start to make decisions based on trying to make other people happy. And that's inauthentic. And that will change depending on who you're spending time with. Have you ever noticed that you're a different person around one group of people and then another? That when I'm at home and with my family, this is who I am, and these are the kind of things that I say, and these are the opinions I share and don't share. This is how I behave. When you're out with your friends, all of a sudden it's different. When you're at work, it's a whole different thing. And sometimes you can, even if you stopped and looked at your life, say, man, I really don't feel like a whole person. I don't feel like I'm the same person. I don't feel like I'm an authentic person. Just kind of bending to who you're with and trying to make them happy or to approve of you. Last week, we talked about trying to fit in. And if you live that way long enough, you become ineffective. That your impact in the world and the people around you is diminished because all you're doing is trying to make other people happy. And what you find is you probably don't do a great job of that. And you've lost that authenticity of being who you are. And now the impact that you can have of that person that God created you to be uniquely is diminished as you try and be what everybody else wants you to be. We become unable to be who God is calling us because we're trying to be who other people want us to be. And this is Saul's great downfall. He had some great victories. He had some tough failures. But what was it that the core of it really got? Well, God's looking at the heart. When people are looking at appearances, and there's Saul caught looking at his appearance, scared of what people might think of him. You know, we could flip this around and say, well, this is pretty negative. None of us want to live that way. We don't want to be insecure people. We don't want to be inauthentic people. We don't want to be ineffective people. We don't want to have the feelings that go along with those things, of course, is, you know, that kind of guilt or the anxiety that comes with that. Having hearts that just are filled with worry. Am I being who I'm supposed to be? Do people like me? Am I being effective? All those kind of things. The flip side is that when our hearts are properly centered, we actually can grow in incredible ways. When our hearts are centered where they need to be, when our hearts connect with God's hearts, when we're allowing God to drill down deep within us and we live out of our center, then we grow in confidence. The person God has created me to be is a good person. That when I'm allowed to be myself, I have a place to stand. I don't have to worry about what everybody else thinks of me and what everybody else wants from me and all the external pressures that they're putting on me. I can be me and I can be confident that God has created me to be me. That's where I get to stand. And the more that you accept that, the more you grow in confidence. I don't have to be insecure. I don't have to be like everybody else. I don't have to be approved by everybody else. I don't have to have everybody like me. I can just be me. We grow in confidence. And we grow in confidence, we grow in character. Being unswayed by unhealthy pressure. Living out our convictions. Not trying to do what everybody else asks us to do, but focusing on our hearts. Well, who am I? And therefore, where do I actually need to grow? Not what is everybody else on the outside telling me I need to be, but my character, the things that make up me, the things that God wants in my life, the things that are healthy and good for the flourishing of my life. I will grow in character because I'm not trying to make everybody else happy. I'm trying to be the best version of myself. When you gain a confidence in that, you also see that the most important thing is character and your growth of character. And the more confident you are, the more you grow in character, the greater capacity you have. Capacity to make a difference in other people's lives. Capacity to impact people around you in a positive way. The capacity to take the strength that you now are experiencing and to allow that to flow out of you. That now you are a stronger person. Stronger in confidence, stronger in character, now with a greater capacity. And this works its way out in every aspect of life. This is not just some religious or spiritual exercise, though it's deeply spiritual. It is the capacity that you'll have to impact people in your family, to be a strong husband or wife, to be a good parent. You're going to see this show up at work. greater capacity to love and care for and do really good things in your work and with your coworkers, to be able to treat them well and fairly, to be a better teammate. It's going to show up in your friendships when you're the kind of person that doesn't just have to, we got to make sure everybody's happy, but instead you can be who you are and therefore care for and love the group of people that you spend time with and that you want to impact well. And when we are able to silence the loud voices of external pressures, then that's when we can hear the whisper of our divine center. And this is why devotional masters in the Christian faith for centuries have talked about needing to get quiet. And not just, audibly quiet, but spiritually quiet. Being able to take some of those external pressures, those voices that sometimes are so loud, this is how you need to look, this is how you need to act, this is how you need to treat, and to be able to quiet those. And on the inside, to be able to hear the divine whisper of God deep inside of us, telling us who we are, reminding us that He is our center out of which we can live, out of which we speak, out of which we behave. What is our center? What does that mean? There's a number of ways devotional masters have talked about it throughout the centuries. They talked about it as contemplative prayer or centering prayer, quieting ourselves and listening to God. Brother Lawrence talked about it in terms of practicing the presence of God, trying to be conscious of the presence of God in as many moments every day as possible. Soren Kierkegaard wrote about the purity of heart is to will one thing. How do I take my desires and point them all towards God all the time, no matter what it is that I'm actually doing? And Jesus taught about that when we get caught up in the anxieties and the worries that plague our hearts of who we're supposed to be and what we need to get and where we need to run to seek first the kingdom, to subvert all of the loud voices that tell us all of the things that we need and who we need to be, the anxieties, the worries, the selfish ambitions, the pride, the jealousy, and to find deep within us a connection with God who has created us to love us and for us to love Him. And to find all the power of our lives to flow from that love, from that awareness of His presence inside of us. So here's a question I'll ask you. Which external pressures distract you the most from your true center? Could you answer that? This week, could you think about that? What are the external pressures? What are the voices that are so loud in your life that distract you from simply knowing confidently deep within you the presence of God? What are the ones that so often tempt you to try and be somebody else or trying to put on some kind of show of who you are? Is it what people think you should literally look like, your actual physical appearance? Maybe that's the loudest voice. This is what you're supposed to look like. This is what beauty means. These are the clothes you have to have and wear. These are the people that have to approve of your looks. I don't know, maybe it's how successful you look. This is how much money I'm supposed to make. This is the title that I'm supposed to have. Maybe there's the approval of certain people in your life that I need to make them happy. That just drives you so much. What are the loudest voices that distract you from saying, whoa, 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 who am I? Where's my true center that I live out of? The presence of God. And being able to maintain a focus on who He is and who He's created me to be. Who are you trying to make happy? Because when you can answer that question, I think you can start really wrestling your way forward. You're trying to figure out, well, how do I quiet those voices and come back to discern who God is saying I am and who I ought to be and what I need to work on? Back to the story, 1 Samuel, and now in verse 12, chapter 16. Sorry, let's go back to verse 8. It says, then Jesse called Abinadab and had him passed in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. So he brings Eliab. We read this a few minutes ago. And Samuel goes, oh, that must be him, kind of the firstborn son. He must look good, all that kind of stuff. And God says, no, I'm rejecting him. The second son comes back, Abinadab. passes in front of him. Samuel said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. Jesse then had Shammah pass by, but Samuel said, nor has the Lord chosen this one. Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, the Lord has not chosen these. So he asked Jesse, are these all the sons you have? There is still the youngest. And actually, there's a way to translate this. Could translate it the smallest or the shortest. Remember this little obsession with height? Tall people? You know, Saul was really tall. I'm not worried about that. Here comes all these guys. And maybe the smallest, the youngest, Jesse answered. He's tending the sheep. We don't really consider him. Samuel said, send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives. Now, this is a great part of the story. For anybody who figures they would not be the first one chosen. For the people who in gym class were always left till the end. For the people who would say, if we're going on looks, I am not going to be picked. If we're going on strength, if we're going on height, if we're going on wealth, I don't make it. This is the moment where if you're reading this story and you're the one that, you know, is not likely to be chosen for something great, you're getting excited because you're going, rejected, rejected, rejected. I know where this is going. I know where this is going. They're going to pick some ugly little runt just like me. You get excited, right? This gives you a little bit of hope. It couldn't be the next one. It's going to be one of us guys that never gets picked. Seven sons come. Seven is a symbolic number. It's the number of enough, but it's not enough. So verse 12, so he sent for him and he had him brought in. He's out doing the dirty work. He's a shepherd. This is not a great position to be in. And then, so you're all pulling for him. You're like, great, God's about to pick the, you know, ugly little runt of the litter. And you get all excited. And then comes the rest of this verse. I love this. This is a little bit of a curveball. It's a bit of this ambiguous, it's great storytelling. It's so good. The end of verse 12 says, so David comes in. He was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features. You go, what? I thought he was going to be ugly. Isn't that the whole point of the story? Man, people don't look, or they're looking at the appearances, the outward appearances, but the Lord looks on the heart. Here's the firstborn son looking good. No, not him. Not the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. Great. Bring out the uggo. And here comes David. And what does it say? He has fine appearance and handsome features. He's a good-looking kid. It's a little bit of a curveball, isn't it? Great storytelling, because now we have this ambiguous moment where we stop and we ask ourselves, how will he respond? He's going to have the same temptations that Saul had to make appearance everything, to look the part, to give in to people. How will he grow? How will he keep his heart centered? Will he make it? Will we? It's a great little tension verse, isn't it? Well, what about us? Are we going to give in? Are we going to find our heart's center and live out of it? Are we going to be distracted? David will have the same temptation that Saul had. And we're going to watch how he does it. So then the Lord said, rise and anoint him. This is the one. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. Samuel then went to Ramah. He went back home. And so we have this moment where now we're waiting with tension. How's David going to do? Because remember, as the king goes, so goes the kingdom. So goes the people. Will he stay centered? Will he find the true center for his heart and lead out of it? And we're left with the same tension. How's your heart? Where do you live out of? What's most important to you? Where do you find your confidence? Where do you start when it comes to build your character? How are you going to fill up your capacity to impact the world? Are we ready to shut out some of those voices that tell us it's about all the things that people can see and to get quiet and to find the divine whisper that speaks to us, his presence, his love, his grace, our identity? David becomes a pretty good king, a man after God's own heart. We're going to see he messes up a lot, makes a lot of mistakes, but in the end is able to find that his heart connected to God's heart in a powerful way such that he gets this incredible title. David is not the ultimate king. When we look at these Old Testament kings, we're always pointing to the greater king, the greatest king. We're pointing to the ultimate king, the king whose heart is one with God's heart, who shows us exactly what God is like. He is King Jesus. He calls us to follow him. Regardless of what other voices say and tell us how we're supposed to live, who we're supposed to be, but with a deep authenticity, he shows us the very heart of God and calls us to join our hearts with his. Will you take that invitation seriously? Whether you're journeying towards Christianity, maybe you don't know if you're going to continue in that, or maybe if you've just been a Christian for decades, but to ask yourself, what are the loudest voices in my life, and where is my heart? Who has my heart? What's my center from where my emotion and my intellect and my morality and everything derives its source? And you might wonder today where your heart is at. Ask yourself where your heart is at. Is it joyful? I mean, deep down? Is it anxious? Is it depressed? Are you worried? Are you filled with confidence that deep within you, you find the presence of God? And as you think about that, and you should know, you know, in this story, we see these descriptions of the physicalities of people like Saul and David. That doesn't happen in the Bible very much. We don't read most figures, like, what does Abraham look like? Nobody knows. I have no idea. Which means when we do hear about this, the appearances of somebody, we know that's significant. Here, we get it in the story. It's all around that verse. People looking at the outward appearance, but God is looking at the heart. So that's what we get. I want you to hear now this prophecy in Isaiah, which Christians believe is fulfilled in Jesus. And hear the description as we close today of what Jesus looks like and what he is like. The true king. It says there was nothing beautiful or majestic about his appearance. Nothing to attract us to him. He was despised and rejected. A man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. We turned our backs on him and looked the other way. He was despised and we did not care. Yet it was our weakness he carried. It was our sorrows that weighed him down. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God, a punishment for his own sins. But he was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so we could be whole. He was whipped so we could be healed. All of us like sheep, we have strayed away. We have left God's path to follow our own. Yet the Lord laid on him the sins of us all. He was oppressed and treated harshly, yet he never said a word. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as sheep is silent before the shearers, he did not open his mouth. Unjustly condemned, he was led away. No one cared that he died without descendants, that his life was cut short in midstream, but he was struck down for the rebellion of people. He had done no wrong and had never deceived anyone, but he was buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave. But it was the Lord's good plan to crush him and cause him grief. Yet when his life is made an offering for sin, he will have many descendants. He will enjoy a long life, and the Lord's good plan will prosper in his hands. When he sees all that is accomplished by his anguish, he will be satisfied. And because of his experience, my righteous servant will make it possible for many to be counted righteous, for he will bear all their sins, our sins. Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for King Jesus, the one who outwardly had nothing to attract us to him, the one whose life looked like it was defeated, the one who didn't speak up out of self-defense, but like a lamb was led to slaughter. The king who is willing to become a servant. The king who is willing to give himself up for the people that he loved. God, thank you that we see your heart in this humble service. We thank you that we see your heart, which is a self-sacrificing love. God, as the king goes, so the people go. And so we want to announce and proclaim today that Jesus Christ is our king. God, thank you for the way he has given himself up for us to forgive our sin and to lead us back to the place where we are the people he's created us to be. God, I pray that this week you would give us courage to acknowledge the voices that are so loud in our lives that distract us, that try and focus our attention too much on things that are superficial. God, I pray that you would help us to see your heart and there to bring our hearts back in alignment with you, that we would live out of your divine presence as our center, the thing that brings everything else into alignment and focus, the thing that gives us our confidence and sets our character on trajectory, the things that gives us capacity to love well and make an impact in this world. God, I pray that you would give us a vision of what's truly important in Jesus Christ, and that you give us the courage to follow, and that we, his people, would be like him. And so we praise the King of Glory. We ask, God, that you would bring our heart into alignment with your heart and there to find your kingdom coming in this world and in our lives. In Jesus' name.